Chapter 10. I was awake all that long night and the next day, writhing in pain, shuttling to the bathroom while carrying my IV drip apparatus, trying painfully to urinate and then checking the absurd filter I had to urinate through for any sign of the kidney stone that was killing me. Sometime in late morning, I passed the thing. For a minute, I couldn't believe it. The pain had been less for the past half hour or so, just the echo of pain in my back and groin, actually. But as I stared at the tiny reddish thing in the filter cone, something larger than a grain of sand but much smaller than a pebble, I couldn't believe that it could have caused such agony for so many hours. "Believe it," Ania said as she sat on the edge of the counter and watched me pull my pajama shirt back in place. "It's often the smallest things in life that cause us the greatest pain." "Yeah," I said. I knew vaguely that Ania was not there, that I would never have urinated in front of anyone like that, much less in front of this girl. I had been hallucinating her presence ever since the first Ultramorph injection.
"Congratulations," said the Ania hallucination.
Her smile seemed real enough, that slightly mischievous, slightly teasing turning up of the right side of her mouth that I'd grown accustomed to, and I could see that she was wearing the green denim slacks and white cotton shirt she often wore when working in the desert heat, but I could also see the sink basin and soft towels through her. "Thanks," I said, and shuffled back to collapse in the bed. I could not believe that the pain would not return. In fact, Dr. Molina had said that there might be several stones. Ania was gone when Demaria, Demloa, and the trooper on guard came into the room.
"Oh, it's wonderful," said Demaria.
"We're so glad," said Demloa.
"We hope that you would not have to go to the PAX infirmary for surgery."
"Put your right hand up here," said the trooper.
He handcuffed me to the brass headboard.
"I'm a prisoner?" I said groggily. "You always have been," grunted the trooper. His dark skin was sweaty under his helmet visor. "The skimmer will be by tomorrow morning to pick you up. Wouldn't want you missing the ride."
He went back out to the shade of the barrel tree out front.
"Ah," said Demloa, touching my handcuffed wrist with her cool fingers.
"We are sorry, Rolandimian."
"It's not your fault," I said, feeling so tired and drugged that my tongue did not want to work right. "You've been nothing but kind. So kind." The fading pain kept me from sleeping.
"Father Clifton would like to come in and speak with you. Would that be all right?"
At that moment, I would have welcomed spider rats nibbling on my toes about as much as the idea of chatting with a missionary priest. I said,
"Sure, why not?"
Father Clifton was younger than I, short, but not as short as Demaria or Demloa or her race, and pudgy, with thinning sandy hair receding from his friendly, flushed face. I thought that I knew his type. There had been a chaplain in the home guard a bit like Father Clifton, earnest, mostly inoffensive, a bit of a mama's boy, who may have gone into the priesthood so that he would never have to grow up and become really responsible for himself. It was Grandam who had pointed out to me how the parish priests in the various moor-end villages on Hyperion tended to remain somewhat childlike, treated with deference by their parishioners, fussed over by housekeepers and women of all ages, never in real competition with other adult males. I don't think that Grandam was actively anti-clerical, in spite of her refusal to accept the cross, just amused by this tendency of parish priests in the great and powerful Pax Empire. Father Clifton wanted to discuss theology. I think that I moaned then, but it must have been taken for a reaction to the kidney stone, for the good priest merely leaned closer, patted my arm, and murmured,
"There, there, my son."
Did I mention that he was at least 5 or 6 years younger than me?
"Rawl. May I call you Rawl?"
"Sure, Father." I closed my eyes as if falling asleep.
"What is your opinion of the church, Rawl?"
Under my eyelids, I rolled my eyes.
"The church, Father?"
Father Clifton waited. I shrugged.
Or to be more precise, I tried to shrug. It's not that easy when one wrist is handcuffed above your head and the other arm is on the receiving end of an intravenous drip. Father Clifton must have understood my awkward motion.
"You're indifferent to it, then?" he asked softly.
"As indifferent as one can be to an organization that's tried to capture or kill me," I thought. "Not indifferent, Father," I said. "It's just that the church, well, it hasn't always been relevant to my life in most ways."
One of the missionary's sandy eyebrows rose slightly.
"Gosh, Rawl, the church is a lot of things, not all of them spotlessly good, I'm sure. But I hardly think that it could be accused of being irrelevant." I considered shrugging again, but decided one awkward spasm of that sort was enough.
"I see what you mean," I said, hoping that the conversation was over.
Father Clifton leaned even closer, his elbows on his knees, his hands set together in front of him, but more in the aspect of persuasion and reason than prayer.
"Rawl, you know that they're taking you back to Base Bombacino in the morning."
I nodded. My head was still free to move.
"You know that the Pax Fleet and Mercantilis' punishment for desertion is death."
"Yeah," I said, "but only after a fair trial." Father Clifton ignored my sarcasm. His brow was wrinkled with what could only be worry, although for my fate or for my eternal soul, I was not sure which. Perhaps for both.
"For Christians," he began and paused a moment. "For Christians, such an execution is punishment, some discomfort, perhaps even momentary terror. But then they mend their ways and go on with their lives. For you..."
"Nothingness," I said, helping him end his sentence. "The big gulp, eternal darkness, nada-ness. I become a worm's casserole."
Father Clifton was not amused. "This does not have to be the case, my son."
I sighed and looked out the window. It was early afternoon on Vitis Gray, Balianus B. The sunlight was different here than on worlds that I had known well. Hyperion, Old Earth, even Mare Infinitus and other places I had visited briefly but intensely. But the difference was so subtle that I would have found it hard to describe. But it was beautiful. There was no arguing that. I looked at the cobalt sky streaked with violet clouds, at the butter-rich light falling on pink adobe and the wooden sill. I listened to the sound of children playing in the alley, to the soft conversation of Cess Ambry and her sick brother Bin, to the sudden, soft laughter as something in the game they were playing amused them, and I thought, to lose all this forever? And I hallucinated Aenea's voice saying, "To lose all this forever is the essence of being human, my love."
Father Clifton cleared his throat.
"Have you ever heard of Pascal's wager, Rawl?"
"Yes."
"You have?"
Father Clifton sounded surprised. I had the feeling that I had thrown him off stride in his prepared line of argument.
"Then you know why it makes sense," he said rather lamely.
I sighed again. The pain was steady now, not coming and going in the tidal surges that had overwhelmed me the past few days. I remembered first encountering Blaise Pascal in conversations with Grandam when I was a kid, then discussing him with Aenea in the Arizona twilight, and finally looking up his Pensée in the excellent library at Taliesin West.
"Pascal was a mathematician," Father Clifton was saying, "pre-Hegira, mid-18th century, I think."
"Actually, he lived in the mid-1600s, I said, 1623 to 1662, I think. Actually, I was bluffing a bit on the dates. The numbers seemed right, but I would not have bet my life on them. I remembered the era because Aenea and I had spent a couple of weeks one winter discussing the Enlightenment and its effect on people and institutions pre-Hegira, pre-Pax.
"Yes," said Father Clifton, "but the time he lived isn't as important as his so-called wager. Consider it, Rawl. On one side, the chance of resurrection, immortality, an eternity in heaven and benefiting from Christ's light. On the other side, how did you put it?"
"The big gulp," I said. "Nada-ness."
"Worse than that," said the young priest, his voice thick with earnest conviction.
Nada means nothingness, sleep without dreams. But Pascal realized that the absence of Christ's redemption is worse than that. It's eternal regret, longing, infinite sadness.
And hell? I said. Eternal punishment?
Father Clifton squeezed his hands together, obviously uncomfortable at that side of the equation.
Perhaps, he said. But even if hell were just eternal recognition of the chances one has lost, why risk that?
Pascal realized that if the church was wrong, nothing would be lost by embracing its hope, and if it was right?
I smiled. A bit cynical, isn't it, Father? The priest's pale eyes looked directly into mine.
Not as cynical as going to your death for no reason, Raw. Not when you can accept Christ as your Lord, do good works among other human beings, serve your community and your brothers and sisters in Christ, and save your physical life and your immortal soul in the process.
I nodded. After a minute, I said, maybe the time he lived was important.
Father Clifton blinked, not following me.
Blaise Pascal, I mean, I said. He lived through an intellectual revolution, the likes of which humanity has rarely seen. On top of that, Copernicus and Kepler and their ilk were opening up the universe a thousandfold. The sun was becoming, well, just a sun, Father. Everything was being displaced, moved aside, shoved from the center. Pascal once said, I am terrified by the eternal silence of these infinite spaces.
Father Clifton leaned closer. I could smell the soap and shaving cream scent on his smooth skin.
All the more reason to consider the wisdom of his wager, Raw.
I blinked, wanting to move away from the pink and freshly scrubbed moon of a face. I was afraid that I smelled of sweat and pain and fear. I had not brushed my teeth in 24 hours. I don't think that I want to make any wager, if it means dealing with a church that has grown so corrupt that it makes obedience and submission the price of its saving the life of someone's child, I said.
Father Clifton pulled away as if slapped. His fair skin flushed a deeper red. Then he stood and patted my arm.
You get some sleep. We'll speak again before you leave tomorrow.
But I did not have until tomorrow. If I had been outside at that moment, looking at just the precise quadrant of the late afternoon sky, I would have seen the scratch of flame across the dome of cobalt as Nemes's dropship entered the landing pattern for Pax Base Bombacino. When Father Clifton left, I fell asleep.
I watched as Ania and I sat in the vestibule of her shelter in the desert night and continued our conversation. I've had this dream before, I said, looking around and touching the stone beneath the canvas of her shelter. The rock still held some of the day's heat.
Yes, said Ania.
She was sipping from a fresh cup of tea.
You are going to tell me the secret that makes you the Messiah, I heard myself say. The secret which makes you the bond between two worlds that the AI Uman spoke of.
Yes, said my young friend and nodded again. But first tell me if you think that your reply to Father Clifton was adequate.
Adequate? I shrugged. I was angry. Ania sipped tea. Steam rose from the cup and touched her lashes.
But you didn't really respond to his question about Pascal's wager.
That was all the response I needed to give, I said, somewhat irritated. Little Binria Dem Loa Alem is dying of cancer. The church uses their cruciform as leverage. That's corrupt, foul. I'll have none of it.
Ania looked at me over the steaming cup.
But if the church were not corrupt, Rawl, if it offered the cruciform without price or reservation, would you accept it?
No.
The immediacy of my answer surprised me. The girl smiled.
So it is not the corruption of the church that is at the heart of your objection. You reject resurrection itself.
I started to speak, hesitated, frowned, and then rephrased what I was thinking. This kind of resurrection I reject, yes.
Still smiling, Ania said. Is there another kind?
The church used to think so, I said. For almost 3,000 years, the resurrection it offered was of the soul, not the body.
And do you believe in that other kind of resurrection?
No, I said again, as quickly as I had before. I shook my head. Pascal's wager never appealed to me. It seems logically shallow.
Perhaps because it posits only two choices, said Aenea.
Somewhere in the desert night, an owl made a short, sharp sound.
Spiritual resurrection and immortality, or death and damnation, she said.
Those last two aren't the same thing, I said.
No, but perhaps to someone like Blaise Pascal they were. Someone terrified of the eternal silence of these infinite spaces.
A spiritual agoraphobic, I said. Aenea laughed. The sound was so sincere and spontaneous that I could not help loving it. Her.
Religion seems to have always offered us that false duality, she said, setting her cup of tea on a flat stone. The silences of infinite space, or the cozy comfort of inner certainty. I made a rude noise.
The Pax Church offers a more pragmatic certainty. Aenea nodded.
That may be its only recourse these days. Perhaps our reservoir of spiritual faith has run out.
Perhaps it should have run out a long time ago, I said sternly. Superstition has taken a terrible toll on our species. Wars, pogroms, resistance to logic and science and medicine. Not to mention gathering power in the hands of people like those who run the packs.
Is all religion superstition then, Rol? All faith then folly?
I squinted at her. The dim light from inside the shelter and the dimmer starlight outside played on her sharp cheekbones and the gentle curve of her chin. What do you mean? I said, correctly expecting a trap.
If you had faith in me, would that be folly?
Faith in you? How? I said, hearing my voice sounding suspicious, almost sullen. As a friend or as a messiah?
What's the difference? Asked Aenea, smiling again in that way that usually meant a challenge was in the offing.
Faith in a friend is friendship, I said. Loyalty. I hesitated. Love.
And faith in a messiah? Said Aenea, her eyes catching the light.
I made a brusque throwing away gesture. That's religion.
But what if your friend is the messiah? She said, smiling openly now.
You mean, what if your friend thinks she's the Messiah? I said. I shrugged again. I guess you stay loyal to her and try to keep her out of the asylum. Aenea's smile faded, but I sensed that it was not because of my harsh comment. Her gaze had turned inward.
I wish it were that simple, my dear friend.
Touched, filled with a wave of anxiety as real as surging nausea, I said, You are going to tell me why you were chosen as this Messiah, kiddo. What makes you the bond between two worlds? The girl, young woman, I realized, nodded solemnly.
I was chosen simply because I was that first child of the core and humankind.
She had said that earlier. I nodded this time. So those are the two worlds which you connect, the core and us?
Two of the worlds, yes, said Aenea, looking up at me again. Not the only two. That's precisely what messiahs do, Rol, bridge different worlds, different eras, provide the bond between two irreconcilable concepts.
And your connection to both these worlds makes you the messiah? I said again. Aenea shook her head quickly, almost impatiently. Something like anger glinted in her eyes.
No, she said sharply. I'm the messiah because of what I can do.
I blinked at her vehemence. What can you do, kiddo? Aenea held out her hand and gently touched me with it.
Remember when I said that the church and Pax were right about me, Rol? That I was a virus?
Uh-huh. She squeezed my wrist.
I can pass that virus, Rol. I can infect others. Geometric progression. A plague of carriers.
Carriers of what, I said? Messiahhood? She shook her head. Her expression was so sad that it made me want to console her, put my arms around her. Her grip remained firm on my wrist.
No, she said, just the next step in what we are, what we can be.
I took a breath. You talked about teaching the physics of love, I said, of understanding love as a basic force of the universe. Is that the virus? Still holding my wrist, she looked at me a long moment.
"That's the source of the virus," she said softly. "What I teach is how to use that energy."
"How?" I whispered. Anea blinked slowly, as if she were the one dreaming and about to awaken.
"Let's say there are 4 steps, she said. 4 stages, 4 levels.
I waited. Her fingers made a loop around my captured wrist.
"The first is learning the language of the dead," she said.
"What is that?"
"Shh."
Anea had raised the first finger of her free hand to her lips to shush me.
"The second is learning the language of the living," she said.
I nodded, not understanding either phrase.
"The third is hearing the music of the spheres," she whispered.
In my reading at Taliesin West, I had run across this ancient phrase. It was all mixed up with astrology, the pre-scientific age on old Earth. Kepler's little wooden models of a solar system predicated on perfect shapes, shells of stars and planets being moved by angels, volumes of double talk. I had no idea what my friend was talking about and how it could apply to an age when humanity moved faster than light through the spiral arm of the galaxy.
"The 4th step, she said, her gaze turned inward again, "is learning to take the 1st step.
"The 1st step, I repeated, confused. "You mean the 1st step you mentioned? What was it, learning the language of the dead?" Anea shook her head, slowly bringing me into focus. It was as if she had been elsewhere for a moment.
"No," she said. "I mean taking the 1st step.
Almost holding my breath, I said, "All right, I'm ready, kiddo. Teach me." Anea smiled again.
"That's the irony, Rawl, my love. If I choose to do this, I'll always be known as the one who teaches. But the silly thing is, I don't have to teach it. I only have to share this virus to impart each of these stages to those who wish to learn."
I looked down at where her slim fingers encircled a part of my wrist. "So you've already given me this virus?" I said. I felt nothing except the usual electric tingle that her touch always created in me. My friend laughed.
"No, Rawl, you're not ready. And it takes communion to share the virus, not just contact. And I haven't decided what to do, if I should do this."
"To share with me?" I said, thinking communion.
"To share with everyone," she whispered, serious again. "With everyone ready to learn."
She looked directly at me again. Somewhere in the desert, a coyote was yipping.
"These levels, stages, can't coexist with a cruciform, Rawl."
"So the born-again can't learn?" I said. "This would rule out the vast majority of human beings." She shook her head.
"They can learn. They just can't stay born again. The cruciform has to go."
I let out my breath. I did not understand most of this, but that's because it seemed to be double talk.
"Don't all would-be messiahs speak double talk?" asked
the cynical part of me in Grand Dam's level voice. Aloud, I said, "There's no way to remove a cruciform without killing the person wearing it, the true death." I had always wondered if this fact had been the main reason I had been unwilling to go under the cross. Or perhaps it was just my youthful belief in my own immortality. Anea did not respond directly. She said,
"You like the Amoyeti Spectrum Helix people, don't you?"
Blinking, I tried to understand this.
Had I dreamed that phrase? Those people, that pain? Wasn't I dreaming now, or was this a memory of a real conversation? But Anea knew nothing of Dem Rhea, Dem Loa, and the others. The night in stone and canvas shelter seemed to ripple like a shredding dreamscape.
"I like them," I said, feeling my friend remove her fingers from my wrist. Wasn't my wrist shackled to the headboard? Anea nodded and sipped her cooling tea.
"There's hope for the Spectrum Helix people, and for all the thousands of other cultures which have reverted or sprung up since the fall. The hegemony meant homogeneity, Rawl. The Pax means even more. The human genome, the human soul, distrusts homogeneity, Rawl. They are always ready to take a chance, to risk change and diversity."
"Anea," I said, reaching for her. I don't... We can't... There was a terrible sense of falling, and the dreamscape came apart like thin cardboard in a hard rain. I could not see my friend.
Wake up, Rawl. They are coming for you. The Pax is coming.
I tried to awaken, groping toward consciousness like a sluggish machine crawling uphill. But the weight of fatigue and the painkillers kept dragging me down. I did not understand why Aenea wanted me awake. We were conversing so well in the dream.
Wake up, Rawl Endymion.
Wake up, Rawl Endymion. It was not Aenea. Even before I was fully awake and focused, I recognized the soft voice and thick dialect of Demria. I sat straight up. The woman was undressing me. I realized that she had pulled the loose nightshirt off and was tugging my undershirt on, cleaned and smelling of fresh breezes now, but unmistakably my undershirt. My undershorts were already on. My twill pants, overshirt, and vest were laid across the bottom of the bed. How had she done this with the handcuff on my... I stared at my wrist. The handcuffs were lying open on the bedclothes. My arm tingled painfully as circulation returned. I licked my lips and tried to speak without slurring. The Pax? Coming? Demria pulled my shirt on as if I were her child, Bin, or younger. I motioned her hands away and tried to close the buttons with suddenly awkward fingers. They had used buttons rather than seal tabs at Taliesin West on old Earth. I thought I had grown used to them, but this was taking forever.
And we heard on the radio that a dropship had landed at Bombacino. There are 4 people in unknown uniforms, 2 men, 2 women. They were asking the Commandant about you. They just lifted off. The dropship and 3 skimmers. They will be here in 4 minutes, perhaps less.
Radio? I said stupidly. I thought you said that the radio didn't work. Isn't that why the priest went to the base to get the doctor?
Father Clifton's radio was not working,
whispered Demria, pulling me to my feet. She held me steady as I stepped into my trousers.
We have radios, tight beam transmitters, satellite relays, all of which the Pax knows nothing about, and spies in place. One has warned us. Hurry, Rawl Endymion. The ships will be here in a minute.
I came fully awake then, literally flushed with a surge of anger and hopelessness that threatened to wash me away. Why won't these bastards leave me alone? 4 people in unknown uniforms. Pax, obviously. Evidently their search for Aenea, Abetic and me, had not ended when the priest captain, DeSoya, had let us escape the trap on God's Grove more than 4 years earlier. I looked at the chronometer readout on my comm log. The ships would be landing in a minute or so. There was nowhere I could run in that time where Pax troopers would not find me. Let me go, I said, pulling away from the short woman in the blue robe. The window was open, the afternoon breeze coming through the curtains. I imagined that I could hear the near ultrasonic hum of skimmers. I have to get away from your house. I had images of the Pax torching the home with young Cess Ambry and Bin still in it. Demria pulled me back from the window. At that moment, the man of the household, young Alem Mikhail Demalem, came in with Demloa. They were carrying the Lusian bulk of the Pax trooper who had been left to guard me. Cess Ambry, her dark eyes bright, was lifting the guard's feet while Bin struggled to pull one of the man's huge boots off. The Lusian was fast asleep, mouth open, drool moistening the high collar of his combat fatigues. I looked at Demria.
Demloa brought him some tea about 15 minutes ago, she said softly.
She made a graceful gesture that caused the blue sleeve of her robe to billow.
I am afraid that we use the rest of your ultramorph prescription, Rawl Endymion.
I have to go, I began. The ache in my back was bearable, but my legs were shaky.
No, said Demria. They will catch you within minutes.
She pointed to the window. From outside there came the unmistakable subsonic rumble of a dropship on EM drive, followed by the thud and bark of its thrusters. The thing must be hovering right above the village, seeking a landing site. A second later, the window vibrated to a triple sonic boom, and 2 black skimmers banked above the adobe buildings next door. Alem Mikhail had stripped the Lusian to his thermal weave underwear and had laid him out on the bed. Now he snapped the man's massive right wrist into the handcuffs and snicked the other cuff around the headboard bar. Dem Loa and Sess Ambri were sweeping up the layers of fatigue clothing, body armor, and huge boots and stuffing them in a laundry bag. Little Bin Ria Dem Loa Alem tossed the guard's helmet in the bag. The thin boy was carrying the heavy flechette pistol. I started at the sight. Children and weapons was a mix I learned to avoid even when I was a child myself, learning to handle power weapons while our caravan rumbled its way across the Hyperion moors. But Alem smiled and took the pistol from the boy, patting him on the back. It was obvious from the way Bin had held the weapon, fingers away from the trigger guard, pointing the muzzle away from himself and his father, checking the safety indicator even as he gave the pistol up, that he had handled such a device before. Bin smiled at me, took the heavy bag with the guard's clothing in it, and ran out of the room. The noise outside rose to a crescendo, and I turned to look out the window. A black skimmer kicked up dust less than 30 meters down the street that ran along the canal. I could see it through a gap between the houses. The larger dropship lowered itself out of sight to the south, probably landing in the grassy open area near the well where I had collapsed in pain from the kidney stone. I had just finished wiggling into my boots and securing my vest when Alem handed me the flechette pistol. I checked the safety and propellant charge indicators out of habit, but then shook my head. "No," I said. "It would be suicide to attack Pax troopers with just this. Their armor." I was not actually thinking about their armor at that moment, but rather about the return fire from assault weapons that would level this house in an instant. I thought of the boy outside with a laundry bag of trooper's armor. "Bin," I said, "if they catch him..."
We know," said Demria, pulling me away from the bed and into the narrow hallway.
I did not remember this part of the house. My universe for the past 40-some hours had been the bedroom and adjoining lavatory.
"Come, come," she said.
I pulled away again, handing the pistol to Alem.
"Just let me run," I said, my heart pounding. I gestured toward the snoring Lusian. "They won't think that's me for a second. They can tight-beam the doctor, if she's not already in one of those skimmers, to ID me. Just tell them..." I looked at the friendly faces in their blue robes. "Tell them that I overpowered the guard and held you at gunpoint." I stopped then, realizing that the guard would destroy that cover story as soon as he awoke. The family's complicity in my escape would be self-evident. I looked at the flechette pistol again, half ready to reach for it. One burst of steel needles and the sleeping trooper would never awaken to destroy the cover-up and endanger these good people. Only I could never do it. I might shoot a Pax trooper in a fair fight. Indeed, the adrenaline rush of anger that was burning through my weakness and terror told me that it would be a welcome relief to have that opportunity. But I could never shoot this sleeping man. But there would be no fair fight. Pax troopers in combat armor, much less these mysterious four in the dropship, Swiss Guard, would be immune to flechettes and anything else short of Pax assault weapons, and the Swiss Guard would be immune to those. I was screwed. These good people who had shown me such kindness were screwed. A rear door slammed open and Bin slid into the hallway, his robe hiked up to show spindly legs covered with dust. I stared at him, thinking that the boy would not get his cruciform and would die of cancer. The adults might well spend the next standard decade in a Pax prison. "I'm sorry," I said, hunting for words. I could hear the commotion in the street as troopers hurried through the evening rush of pedestrians.
"Roland Dimion," said Dem Loa in her soft voice, handing me the rucksack they had brought for my kayak. "Please shut up and follow us. At once."
There was a tunnel entrance beneath the floor of the hallway. I had always thought that hidden passages were the stuff of old hollow dramas, but I followed Demria into this one willingly enough. We were a strange procession, Dim Ria and Dem Loa sweeping down the steep staircase ahead of me, then me carrying the flechette pistol and fumbling the rucksack on my back, then little Bin followed by his sister Sess Ambri, then carefully locking the trap door behind him.
Alem Mikhail Dem Alem. No one stayed behind. The house was empty except for the snoring Lusian trooper. The stairway went deeper than a normal basement level, and at first I thought that the walls were adobe like the ones above. Then I realized that the passage was cut from a soft stone, perhaps sandstone. 27 steps and we reached the bottom of the vertical shaft, and Demria led the way down a narrow passage, illuminated by pale chemical glow globes. I wondered why this average, working-class home would have an underground passage. As if reading my mind, Demloa's blue cowl turned and she whispered, "The Amoyeti Spectrum Helix demands, discreet entrances to one another's homes, especially during the twice darkness." "Twice darkness?" I whispered back, ducking under one of the globes. We had already gone 20 or 25 meters, away from the canal river, I thought, and the passage still curved out of sight to the right. "The slow dual eclipse of the sun by this world's two moons," whispered Demloa. "It lasts precisely 19 minutes. It is the primary reason that we chose this world. Please excuse the pun." "Ah," I said. I did not understand, but it didn't seem to matter at that moment. "Pak's troops have sensors to find spider holes like this," I whispered to the women in front of me. "They have deep radar to search through rock. They have..." "Yes, yes," said Alem from behind me. "But they will be held up a few minutes by the mayor and the others."
"The mayor?" I repeated rather stupidly. My legs were still weak from the 2 days in bed and pain. My back and groin ached, but it was a minor pain, inconsequential, compared to what I had passed through and what had passed through me during the last couple of days.
"The mayor is challenging the Pax's right to search," whispered Demria. The passage widened and went straight for at least 100 meters. We passed 2 branching tunnels. This wasn't a bolt hole, it was a bloody catacombs. "The Pax recognizes the mayor's authority in Lockchild Lamond," she whispered.
The silken robes of the 5 family members in blue were also whispering against the sandstone as we hurried down the passage.
"We still have law and courts on Vitus Gray Balianus B, so they are not allowed unlimited search and seizure rights."
"But they'll download permission from whatever authority they need," I said, hurrying to keep up with the women. We came to another juncture and they turned right.
"Eventually," said Demloa.
"But the streets are now filled with all of the colors of the Lockchild Lamond strand of the Helix. Reds, whites, greens, ebonies, yellows. Thousands of people from our village. And many more are coming from nearby locks. No one will volunteer which house is the one where you are kept. Father Clifton has been lured out of town on a ruse, so he can be of no help to the Pax troopers. Dr. Molina has been detained in Karoa Tambat by some of our people and is currently out of touch with her Pax superiors. And your guard will be sleeping for at least another hour. This way." We turned left into a wider passage, stopped at the first door we had seen, waited for Demria to palm-lock it open, and then stepped into a large, echoing space carved into the stone. We were standing on a metal stairway looking down on what appeared to be a subterranean garage. 6 long, slim vehicles with oversized wheels, stern wings, sails, and pedals clustered by primary colors. These things were like buckboards set on spidery suspensions, obviously powered by wind and muscle power, and covered over with wood, bright, silky polymer fabrics, and perspex.
"Wind cycles," said Sess Ambry.
Several men and women in emerald green robes and high boots were preparing 3 of the wagons for departure. Lashed in the back of one of the long wagon beds was my kayak. Everyone was moving down the clattering staircase, but I stopped at the head of the stairs. My balking was so sudden that poor Bin and Sess Ambry almost crashed into me.
"What is it?" said Alem Mikhail.
I had tucked the flechet pistol in my belt, and now I opened my hands.
"Why are you doing this? Why is everyone helping? What's going on?"
Demria took a step back up the metal staircase and leaned on the railing. Her eyes were as bright as her daughter's had been.
"If they take you, Rolandimian, they will kill you."
"How do you know?" I said. My voice was soft, but the acoustics of the underground garage were such that the men and women in green looked up from where they were working below.
You spoke in your sleep, said Demloa. I cocked my head, not understanding. I had been dreaming of Anea and our conversation. What would that have told these people? Demria took another step upward and touched my wrist with her cool hand. The Amoyeti Spectrum Helix has foretold this woman, Rolandimian, this one named Anea. We call her the one who teaches. I felt goosebumps at that moment in the chill glow-globe light of this buried place. The old poet, Uncle Martin, had spoken of my young friend as a messiah, but his cynicism leaked into everything he said or did. The people of Taliesin West had respected Anea, but to believe that the energetic 16-year-old was actually a world historical figure, it seemed unlikely. And the girl and I had spoken of it in real life and in my ultramorph dreams, but, my God, I was on a world scores of light years away from Hyperion and an eternal distance from the lesser Magellanic cloud where old Earth was hidden. How had these people? Halpul Amoyeti knew of the one who teaches when he composed the Helix Symphony, said Demloa. All of the people of the Spectrum were descended from empath stock. The Helix was and is a way to refine that empathic ability. I shook my head. I'm sorry, I don't understand. Please understand this, Rolandimian, said Demria, her fingers squeezing my wrist almost painfully. If you do not escape this place, the Pax will have your soul and body, and the one who teaches needs both these things. I squinted at the woman, thinking that she was jesting, but her pleasant, unlined face was set and serious. Please, said little Bin, setting his little hand in my free one and pulling. Please hurry, Rol. I hurried down the stairs. One of the men in green handed me a red robe. Alem Mikhail helped me fold and wrap it over my own clothes. He wrapped the red burnoose and cowl in a dozen quick strokes. I would never have been able to arrange it properly. I realized with a shock that the entire family, the two older women, teenaged Tess Ambry and little Bin, had stripped naked from their blue robes and were arranging red ones around them. I saw then that I had been wrong, thinking that they were like Lusians. For although their bodies were shorter than pack space average and heavily muscled, they were perfectly proportioned. None of the adults had any hair, either on their heads or elsewhere. Somehow this made their compact, perfectly toned bodies more attractive. I looked away, realizing that I was blushing. Cess Ambry laughed and jostled my arm. We were all in red robes now, Alem Mikhail being the last to pull his on. One glance at his heavily muscled upper torso told me that I would not last 15 seconds in a fight with the shorter man. But then I realized I probably would not last more than 30 seconds with Demloa or Demria either. I offered the fleshhead pistol to Alem, but he gestured for me to keep it, and showed me how to tuck it in one of the multiple sashes of the long crimson robe. I thought of my lack of weapons in the little backpack, a Navajo hunting knife and the little flashlight laser, and nodded my gratitude. The women and children and I were hurried into the back of the wind cycle wagon that held my kayak, and red fabric was pulled tight over the stays above us. We had to crouch low as a second layer of fabric, some wooden planks, and various crates and barrels were set in around and above us. I could just make out a glimpse of light between the tailgate and the wagon cover. I listened to footsteps on stone as Alem went up front and crawled onto one of the two pedaling saddles. I listened as one of the other men, also now in a red robe, joined him on the cycling seat on the other side of the central yoke. With the mast still lowered above us, fabric sails reefed, we began rolling up a long ramp out of the garage. "Where are we going?" I whispered to Demria, who was lying almost next to me. The wood smelled like cedar. "The downstream farcaster arch," she whispered back. I blinked. "You know about that?" "They gave you truth-tell," whispered Demloa from the other side of a crate. "And you did speak in your sleep." Bin was lying right next to me in the darkness. "We know the one who teaches has sent you on a mission," he said almost happily. "We know you have to get to the next arch." He patted the kayak that curved next to us. "I wish I could go with you." "This is too dangerous," I hissed, feeling the wagon roll out of the tunnel and into open air. Low sunlight illuminated the fabric above us. The wind cycle wagon stopped for a second as the two men cranked the mast erect and unfurled the sail.
Too dangerous.
I meant them taking me to the Farcaster, of course, not the mission that Anea had sent me on.
If they know who I am, I whispered to Demria, they'll be watching the arch.
I could see the silhouette of her cowl as she nodded.
They will be watching, Rol Endymion, and it is dangerous, but darkness is almost here in 14 minutes.
I glanced at my comm log. It would be another 90 minutes or more until twilight, according to what I had observed the previous 2 days, and then almost another full hour until true nightfall.
It is only 6 kilometers to the downstream arch, whispered Cess Ambry from her place on the other side of the kayak. The villages will be filled with the spectrum celebrating.
I understood then. The twice darkness, I whispered.
Yes, said Demria. She patted my hand. We must be silent now. We will be moving into traffic along the saltway.
Too dangerous, I whispered one last time as the wagon began creaking and groaning its way into traffic. I could hear the chain drive rumbling beneath the buckboard floor and feel the wind catch the sail. Too dangerous, I said only to myself. If I had known what was happening a few 100 meters away, I would have realized how truly dangerous this moment was. I peered out through the gap between wagon wood and fabric as we rumbled along the saltway. This vehicle thoroughfare appeared to be a strip of rock-hard salt between the villages clustered along the raised canal and the reticulated desert stretching as far north as I could see.
Waste, Wahabi, whispered Demria as we picked up speed and headed south along the saltway.
Other wind cycle wagons roared past, heading south, their sails fully engaged, their two peddlers working madly. Even more brightly canvassed wagons tacked north, their sails set differently, the peddlers leaning far out for balance as the creaking wagons teetered on 2 wheels, the other 2 spinning uselessly in the air. We covered the 6 kilometers in 10 minutes and turned off the saltway onto a paved ramp that led through a cluster of homes. White stone this time, not adobe. And then Alem and the other man furled the sail and pedaled the wind cycle slowly along the cobblestone street that ran between the homes and the canal river. High, wispy ferns grew along the canal banks there between elaborately fashioned piers, gazebos, and multi-tiered docks to which were tied ornate houseboats. The city seemed to end here where the canal widened into a waterway much more river-like than artificial. And I raised my head enough to see the huge Farcaster arch a few 100 meters downstream. Through and beyond the rusted arch, I could see only fern forest on the riverbanks and desert waste to the east and west. Alem guided the wind cycle onto a brick loading ramp and pulled under the cover of a copse of tall ferns. I glanced at my comm log, less than 2 minutes until the twice darkness. At that instant, there was a rush of warm air and a shadow passed over us. We all crouched lower as the black pack skimmer flew out over the river at an altitude of less than 100 meters. The aerodynamic figure-8 shape of the thing, clearly visible as it banked more steeply, and then swooped low above the ships headed north and south through the arch. River traffic was brisk here where the river widened. Sleek racing sculls with rowing teams of 4 to 12, gleaming powerboats throwing up glistening wakes, sailboats ranging from single-person jitabouts to wallowing square-sailed junks, canoes and rowboats, some stately houseboats churning against the current, a handful of silent electric hovercraft moving within their halos of spray, and even some rafts that reminded me of my earlier voyage with Anea and A. Betic. The skimmer flew low over these ships, passed over the Farcaster arch headed south, flew back under it headed north, and disappeared in the direction of Lochchild Lomond.
Come, said Alem Mikael, folding back the fabric tarp above us and pulling at the kayak. We must hurry.
Suddenly there was a rush of warm air, followed by a cooler breeze that kicked dust off the riverbank. The fern heads rustled and shook above us, and the sky grew purple and then black. Stars came out. I glanced upward just long enough to see a beaded corona around one of the moons and the burning disk of the second lower satellite as it moved into place behind the first. From north along the river, back in the direction of the linear city that included Lochchild Lomond, there came the most haunting and mournful sound I had ever heard. A long wailing, more human-throated than siren caused, followed by a sustained note that grew deeper and deeper until it fell into the subsonic. I realized that I had heard hundreds, perhaps thousands, of horns played at the same instant that thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, of human voices had joined in chorus. The darkness around us grew deeper. The stars blazed. The disk of the lower moon was like some great backlit dome that threatened to drop on the darkened world at any moment. Suddenly, the many ships on the river to the south and the canal river to the north began wailing with their own sirens and horns. A cacophonous howl this, nothing like the descending harmony of the opening chorus, and then began firing off flares and fireworks. Multicolored star shells, roaring St. Catherine's wheels, red parachute flares, braided strands of yellow, blue, green, red, and white fire, the spectrum helix, and countless aerial bombs. The noise and light were all but overwhelming. "Hurry," repeated Alem, pulling the kayak from the wagon bed. I jumped out to help him and pulled off my concealing robe, tossing it into the back of the wagon. The next minute was a flurry of coordinated motion as Demria, Demloa, Sesambri Bin, and I helped Alem and the unnamed man carry the kayak down to the river's edge and set it afloat. I went into the warm water up to my knees, stowed my backpack and the flechette pistol inside the little cockpit, held the kayak steady against the current, and looked at the two women, two young people, and two men in their billowing robes. "What is to happen to you?" I asked. My back ached from the aftermath of the kidney stone, but at the moment the tightening of my throat was the more painful distraction. Demria shook her head. "Nothing bad will happen to us, Rall Endymion. If the Pax authorities attempt to make trouble, we will simply disappear into the tunnels beneath Waste Wahhabi until it is time to rejoin the spectrum elsewhere." She smiled and adjusted her robe on her shoulder. "But make us one promise, Rall Endymion."
"Anything," I said. "If I can do it, I will."
"If it is possible, ask the one who teaches to return with you to Vitus Grey Balianus B, and the people of the Amoyeti Spectrum Helix. We shall try not to convert to the Pax's Christianity until she comes to speak to us." I nodded, looking at Bin Rhea Dem Loa Alem's shaven skull, his red cowl flapping around him in the breeze, his cheeks gaunt with chemotherapy, his eyes gleaming more with excitement than reflected fireworks. "Yes," I said. "If it is at all possible, I will do that." They all touched me then, not to shake hands, but merely to touch, fingers against my vest or arm or face or back. I touched them back, turned the bow of the kayak into the current, and stepped into the cockpit. The paddle was in the hull clamp where I had left it. I tightened the cockpit skirt around me as if there were white water ahead, bumped my hand against the clear plastic cover over the red panic button that Ania had shown me as I set the pistol on the cockpit skirt. If this interlude had not caused me to panic, I was not sure what could. Held the paddle in my left hand and waved farewell with my right. The six-robed figures blended into the shadows beneath the ferns as the kayak swept out into the middle current. The Farcaster arch grew larger. Overhead, the first moon began to move beyond the disk of the sun, but the second, larger moon moved to cover both with its bulk. The fireworks and siren sounds continued, even grew in ferocity. I paddled closer to the right bank as I came closer to the Farcaster, trying to stay in the small boat traffic headed downstream, but not too close to anyone. If they are going to intercept me, I thought, they will do it here. Without thinking, I raised the flechette pistol onto the curve of hull in front of me. The swift current had me now, and I set the paddle in its bracket and waited to pass under the Farcaster. No other ships or small boats would be under the Farcaster when it activated. Above me, the arch was a curve of blackness against the starry sky. Suddenly, there was violent commotion on the riverbank, not 20 meters to my right. I raised the pistol and stared, not understanding what I was seeing and hearing. Two explosions like sonic booms, strobe flashes of white light. More fireworks? No, these flashes were much brighter. Energy weapons fire? Too bright. Too unfocused. It was more like small plasma explosives going off. Then I saw something in a blink of an eye, more a retinal echo than a true vision. Two figures locked in a violent embrace, images reversed like a negative of an ancient photograph. Sudden violent motion, another sonic boom, a flash of white that blinded me even before the image had registered in my brain. Spikes, thorns, two heads butting together, six arms flailing, sparks flying, a human form and something larger. The sound of metal rending, the sound of something or someone screaming, with a voice louder than the sirens wailing on the river behind me. The shockwave from whatever was happening on the bank rippled out across the river, almost tumbled my kayak, and proceeded across the water like a curtain of white spray. Then I was under the Farcaster arch. There was the flash and instant vertigo I had known before. A bright light surrounded me through the flash bulb brightness, and the kayak and I were falling. Truly falling, tumbling into space. A section of water that had been Farcast under me fell away into a brief waterfall. But then the kayak was falling free from the water, spinning as it fell, and in my panic I dropped the flashhead pistol into the cockpit and grabbed the hull of the kayak, setting it spinning more wildly as it fell. I blinked through the flash echoes and tried to see how far I had to fall, even as the kayak went bow down and picked up speed. Blue sky above, clouds all around, huge clouds, stratocumulus rising thousands of meters above and falling more thousands of meters below. Cirrus many kilometers above me, black thunderstorms many more kilometers below. There was nothing but sky and I was falling into it. Beneath me, the brief waterfall from the river had separated into giant teardrops of moisture, as if someone had taken 100 buckets of water and hurled them into a bottomless chasm. The kayak spun and threatened to go stern over bow. I shifted forward in the little kayak and almost tumbled out, with only my crossed legs and the lashing of the little moisture skirt holding me in. I grabbed the rim of the cockpit in a white-knuckled, hopeless grip. Cold air whipped and roared around me as the kayak and I picked up speed, hurtling toward terminal velocity. Thousands and thousands of meters of empty, open air lay between me and the lightning-darted clouds so far below. The two-bladed paddle ripped from its bracket and tumbled away in freefall. I did the only thing I could do under the circumstances. I opened my mouth and screamed.